So the record comes out, 500 copies. What do you do with the record?
Well, we sold them at dances, trying to recoup the cost of recording. At one point, we earned enough money to pay for the recording, and we'd give them away at dances. I recall one point going down to Columbia Park and throwing some out like Frisbees to see how they sailed. It's probably why we don't have any copies today.
Did the record get any airplay?
Yes, it did. Both sides.
On which stations?
I believe both WDGY and KDWB.
How did they get a copy of the record?
I believe we gave it to them.
You drove to the studio and gave them a copy?
I don't know if the people in the band did, but, you know, it was either my father or some of us in the band because, yeah, they had copies and they played it.
Do you recall the very first time you heard your record being played on the local radio station?
Actually, I do. And, you know, I was in the car and I heard it on the car radio and I thought it was, you know, probably a pretty typical reaction. But when you hear yourself on the radio, it's a little bit surreal. You know, you're not something you were expecting probably.
Was it the A side or the B side you heard, Mike?
The first I heard was the A side.
Danny, how about you?
About the same for me. Yeah, it was kind of scary, but yet fun, you know, to hear it. I didn't feel probably as well as Richie Valens did when he heard his first recording, but it was still good.
Bruce, do you recall hearing the record on the radio?
I did not.
Okay.
I didn't hear it. I don't believe it was played on the radio.
Well,
he was still in detention.
In June 65, all of you graduate from high school. And what happens at that point with the Bad Omens?
Well, I think we were looking seriously at this new phenomenon. There was literally hundreds of garage bands around the Twin Cities. However, we had risen to a level where we're getting paid good money to do gigs, and in some cases, you know, playing Dayton's top floor ballroom with 500 kids dancing. It was very exciting, and we wanted to continue on with this ride, this wonderful experience that was happening, and a few bands were making it to that level. So we decided we wanted to get professional, and that included buying outfits that matched, and also getting some agents, and including joining the musicians' union so we could garner some decent salaries.
And do you recall where you purchased your outfits for your stage outfits?
One stop we made was in Dayton's downtown, where we bought velour tops that were striped, aqua and green or gray, and then checkerboard wool hip hugger bell bottom pants with big belts and buckles and high heeled shoes. And then we also bought another pair of boots, beetle type boots with zippers up the side, black boots, all foreign to normal clothing that we wore at school.
Now, this is the British look, correct?
Right.
All the British bands were wearing this style.
We had the pipeline to the early British music. Why not capitalize on that look?
Were other bands at the time also starting to be influenced by the British invasion?
Well, I believe so. Like Bruce had mentioned, there was a number of bands that were climbing up with us at the same time. And as well as the clothes that Bruce just described to try not to offend some of the elders at some of these proms that we played at, we also purchased herringbone suits with a tie.
A formal look.
Very much so, yeah.
Mike, what do you recall about the teen fair in August 65? And I understand you were in two band contests.
Yes, the one was the Fender contest, and I believe that was 250 or more bands in that contest, and the other one was the Gibson contest. And I believe we came in third in the Fender, and I think it was second, you know, some guys remember first, but some remember second in the Gibson. Then we packed up all our gear, and we went to play at the Fridley Youth Center that same day, after we were done with that one, we packed up our gear again and went to play a fraternity party at the University of Minnesota, so we ended up playing four times that day.
Four jobs in one day. You might have set a record.
Yes,
by the way, I do have the trophies at my house.
You got trophies for the contest?
For the Fender and the Gibson.
Okay, and is that correct that you came in?
Who has the trophies?
Bruce.
I do, yeah. I will have to look at them to see, but I think it probably was third and second.
Well, that seems, coming in third out of 250 bands certainly seems like quite an accomplishment to me. Now, I understand at the Teen Fair there were a couple of very important booking agents there. One, Dick Shapiro, and two, Bill Deal from Central Booking Alliance. Do you recall running into those guys at the fair, or what happened with Dick Shapiro and Bill Deal after the fair?
Maybe Mike can remember how this came about with these two. I do remember being approached by them, but I think Mike might have handled the conversation to get things rolling.
Mike, do you recall running into...
I believe that was when they probably saw us for one of the first times, and definitely they were there to add bands to their roster, and I believe that was the first that they started talking to us about joining Central Booking Agency, and they told us they thought they could do, you know, a lot for our band and everything, so... I believe that was the beginning of them starting to possibly book some things for us, although I don't think it started off like gangbusters or anything.
Now, I understand also from talking to you, Mike, that this was the first time you ran into Mike O'Gara?
That was the first time I saw Mike O'Gara. He was playing in a group called the Frenchmen from St. Paul. We saw them playing at the fair as well. I was impressed with his voice and again, their choice of material and everything.
Did you have a discussion with Mike O'Gara about joining the Bad Omens?
Yeah, and that was the first time I ever approached Mike. We started talking about the potential of singing together somehow, and that was what got it rolling that way.
So he joins the band, and what does he play?
He plays rhythm guitar.
And he, I believe, is also a singer as well?
Well, yep.
So how does that change the band with Mike O'Gara?
With Mike O'Gara in the band, I think we started doing, we were somewhat vocally oriented anyway, and I think we became even more so where we started doing, Righteous Brothers was real big at the time. We started doing some Righteous Brothers. One of the groups in England that was doing... like duos and strong harmony is the Walker Brothers. We also started doing some of their material. So I think it changed in terms of, there was more, we just had more vocals on stage, and we were always, I think, into Denny and I singing on as much as possible, and with O'Gara in the group, we had the potential for three-part harmony, so.
Denny, you have a comment on that?
Well, I was just going to add that having Mike O'Gara along with Mike Flaherty was like a Righteous Brothers combination. Mike Flaherty could go endless in falsetto, and Mike O'Gara could bottom. And between the two of them and me kind of slide in between them, we could cover pretty much anything for harmonies.
And I understand the band did a couple, I guess we would sort of call them novelty songs. One by the local band, the Novas, out of Edina, Do the Crusher, and one by the Kingsmen of Louie Louie fame, the Jolly Green Giant. And who's doing lead on those?
Well, I think initially Larry Hotchkiss had done like the Jolly Green Giant, but then after he left, we wanted to make sure that the lead singers didn't destroy their voices. So the non-singer, me, would take on the role of the Crusher and the Jolly Green Giant, ho, ho, ho. And so that would save their voices for the better songs.
So, Bruce, when you did the Crusher, did that give you a sore throat for the rest of the night?
Absolutely.
We do have a list of songs here. Why don't we run through some of these songs? Danny, you want to read through some of these songs we have?
Sure.
The band did?
Yep. Yeah, we mixed it up pretty well with the groups. We love the Rascals, the Young Rascals, so we did a song by them called Ain't Gonna Eat Out My Heart Anymore. You hardly ever hear this one at all on the radio. But we moved on to a little more obscure stuff like My Little Red Book by Love, Mystic Eyes by them, Hazy Shade of Winter, Simon and Garfunkel, several Mamas and Papas, but the one we really liked was I Call Your Name, and Somebody Help Me, Spencer Davis, Sunshine Superman by Donovan, Shaken All Over by the Guess Who, and Make It Easy on Yourself by the Walker Brothers.
Bruce, you want to take over and read some of the other songs?
Boom Boom by the Animals. I love the animal stuff because of the organ parts. We Got to Get Out of This Place Again by the Animals. Reach Out by the Four Tops. Stop, Get a Ticket by Clefs of Lavender Hill.
Now that's sort of obscure. Does anybody have the story on where that song came from or where that band was out of?
Which one is that?
Stop, Get a Ticket by the Clefs of Lavender Hill.
Clefs of Lavender Hill was a Florida group.
Was that song actually on the radio here in town?
I believe it actually made the bottom halves of the charts. I don't know how high it climbed, but I was hearing it on the radio back then.
Danny, you have a comment?
Interesting. I don't remember that part. I remember we picked that record up from somewhere, knowing it was from Florida. But I guess I'm not sure if I actually heard that song locally.
Okay, and Bruce, any more songs on the list?
Well, we have Time Won't Let Me by The Outsiders.
Very popular song for bands at the time.
I See the Light by the Five Americans.
So at this point in time, now you're being booked by Central Booking. How many jobs are you playing on average per week?
Anybody? Okay. Well, we play quite a bit for a while. I had a calendar at one point that I kept track of on the bookings, and I wish I could have found it. But we had a month in October where we played 30 gigs in the month of October alone. And that's on top of school, family issues, and whatever we're doing in between. So it was a very busy time, but yes, we were busy. And unfortunately for us, a lot of our gigs were not in town. Most of it was on the road.
So what did the band have for a band vehicle?
We had a black Cadillac hearse, and it could haul all of our gear. Two people could ride in back and three in the front. And if we played an outstate ballroom, coming home late at night, sometimes everyone would be snoozing, including the driver. So when I was driving, I'd roll down the window and stick my head out the window and scream to try and wake myself up. And the other guys would say, knock it off, we're trying to sleep.
So Bruce, driving a 1951 black Cadillac hearse around the state and outstate, did that ever draw the attention of law enforcement?
Oh, absolutely. It would draw the attention of many people, especially when we would stop somewhere at a roadside place and get out. And some of our band members were sporting long hair now and bell-bottom pants, and of course it was good gawking material.
So in small town mid-America, they might not have seen too many band members with long hair getting out of a hearse at a local restaurant or truck stop.
No, at a truck stop at 2 o'clock in the morning, we come parading in. I remember this one truck driver eating on white bread a patty of raw hamburger. And I remember asking, I said, you like it rare? And he said, I like it rare. And then he looked at Mike Flaherty and just shook his head.
Danny, do you recall the places in town, the Twin Cities area, where the Bad Omens played often?
Yes, I do. We played at Mr. Lucky's in Minneapolis on Lake Street, I believe, and the Safari Club, and Dayton's 8th Floor Auditorium. That was a regular for us. And Danceland in Excelsior, Marigold Ballroom. I believe the Marigold is where we had our first union job, if memory serves me correct. Bruce, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Prom Center in St. Paul, the Lion's Den, another great place to play for local groups, and of course the Bellray Ballroom.
Mike, do you recall the union job at the Marigold Ballroom? Was that with the Castaways?
Yes, it was a battle of the bands with the Castaways.
Just you and the Castaways?
Yes, I believe so. That was back when they, you know, a battle of the bands was really just a catch-all for, they had two bands playing, you know. They had the same thing at the Prom Center where they had the big band play, and then they'd have a rock band play, and they called those battle of the bands, too.
Now, I believe you told me, Mike, that you learned Liar Liar and played it for that show, correct?
Yeah, actually, you should probably ask Denny. This is Denny's story, but he claims that we played Liar Liar when we played with the Castaways, which was kind of bold, I guess.
All right, I'll ask him. Denny, do you recall playing Liar Liar with the Castaways?
Yeah, I do, actually. Aside from being extremely nervous, our first union gig, a huge hall, and playing with a national group, I couldn't get more frightening than that. But yeah, we were pretty gutsy. We had learned Liar Liar and played it locally, and we thought, well, it's part of our song list today. We shall do it. And we did. And in the course of the next year or so, we played several gigs with the Del Counts. And one of the musicians in that group, I won't name him at the time, would come to us from time to time and say, we think you did just as good, if not better, than the Castaways on the song. So that was a compliment coming from a very good group.
And Bruce, what about some of the outstate venues in Minnesota and across the border in Wisconsin where the Bad Omens played?
Well, yeah, it always entailed an enormous amount of driving, and I think Denny and I shared being drivers for one reason or another. So, yeah, it was a great deal of planning to try and arrive at the gig on time to set up, and then, of course, the drive home. We had played up near Fargo one night, and it was 20 below temperature, 60 below wind chill. And we had, we're driving back, and we had two flat tires on the hearse in no man's land. And so we had a kerosene heater in the back, and we figured we better send someone into a town to get help. So we flipped a coin, or I don't know how it was decided, but I went into town, hitched a ride with a Star Tribune delivery truck into a town. And the driver said, I know where the garage owner lives. And we went and pounded on his door, got him up. He went out there at that temperature with bare hands and took the lug nuts off those tires. It was unbelievable.
With his hands?
With his hands. And it took me 2 days to warm up because I was helping him change the tires. But it was 60 below.
This is late at night.
Yeah. So, the outstate gigs were fun, but they had their drawbacks.
And what were some of the venues you played outstate?
Well, we did Albert Lee Armory, Bemidji Armory, Brainerd Armory, Stillwater Armory. You think we were in the National Guard. Fairgrounds Garden, St. Cloud Interlochen Ballroom, George's Ballroom in New Ulm, Playmore Ballroom in Rochester. And there was one in southern Minnesota. I remember it had an enormous number of steps going up to the ballroom, and I remember the week before another band had played there, and they dropped their Farfisa organ, and it went all the way down the steps and ended up at the bottom in a pile of keys. And I thought, I don't want that to happen with mine.
Would that be the Austin Ballroom?
I think so, yeah.
Tower.
The Tower Ballroom.
Tower, yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. We carried his Thomas organ in our earlier years up and down. It took all four of us, and it was a killer to do.
And how about in Wisconsin?
Well, we had Rainbow Garden in Rice Lake, Richards Pavilion in Clayton, Wisconsin. And Wisconsin was, in my opinion, less desirable in terms of, first of all, their roads didn't have shoulders. So if you had car trouble, you couldn't pull off, really. And the other thing was we had heard that another band from the cities had been shot at by a gang.
We played South Dakota, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, South Dakota, yeah. That was an interesting one. We got accused of ruining a parking lot.
Ruining a parking lot in South Dakota.
Well, we played a gig. We had a hotel room, and then we came back from the gig, and I said, well, let's park
there
over here.
There was a club we actually played there a number of times.
Right. And this whole parking lot was open. I said, well, let's go and park in there. And so I took a big turn around the place and parked it by the front. And the next morning we came out, and there was a bunch of workmen at the front desk. And finally the clerk at the front desk turns and says, well, here they are now. And they all turned at us and said, come here. And they pointed out there, and here are these huge tire marks in a freshly paved parking lot. And we didn't know at the time that it was freshly. They said, we had barricades up. Well, one of the barricades was actually down. So luckily we didn't have to pay for that parking lot.
So you drove over freshly paved blacktop without knowing.
With a hearse.
With a hearse and left some tire tracks in the blacktop. What do you recall? What city that was in?
Watertown,
South Dakota.
Oh yeah, I'll never forget the ride up. I got pulled over. I was driving up, and a highway patrolman pulled me over. He wanted to see identification, insurance, and ownership of this hearse. Now, I believe it was a four-lane highway, and we needed to make a left-hand turn, so I'm in the left lane. He pulls me over and scolds me for driving in the left lane, which he claimed was for passing only. And so I challenged him and said, okay, so I need to make this left turn, officer. Would you like me to make this turn from the right-hand lane? And then he got in his car and left.
Well, you might have lucked out there.
I think I did, yeah.
Now, something happened, I understand, to the first hearse. Was there a accident?
Yes. We were up in Foley, Minnesota, and there was, a Corvair in front of us on a two-lane highway turning left. So I was driving, I pulled up to stop, and shortly after that, we were hit from behind by a Rambler automobile, and it just shot our vehicle forward just with the impact. I had the two plate glass windows slid behind my head so we could talk to the guys in back of the hearse, and my head went back and cracked both those windows. So that's how hard we got hit. I think, were we able to drive it home?
No, we did not drive it home. The gas tank was actually split, and gas was leaking out the back. So we called, I think it was me and my brother, went to a local farmhouse or whatever the first housing we could find, asked to use the phone, and we called Mike Flaherty's dad. And he brought, I believe, the other hearse up that we had and came and collected us up along with the equipment and then brought us back. And we never made it to the gig because it just consumed, you know, most of our evening to get through this whole ordeal.
Mike, what was the other hearse?
The second vehicle was a COB, a combination hearse ambulance, I believe is kind of a beige color, kind of a cream beige.
Do you recall the year of that one?
Bruce would probably be the best one on that, the year of the vehicle.
That was a 1956 Cadillac, and it had operational red lights on the top of the vehicle. And there were times when we would actually use them. Sometimes if we were late for a gig, we'd have to pop them on and have cars pull over. And then there was a parking spot for lovers in Northeast Minneapolis where we would come in after a gig, and here's all these automobiles parked, and these people are, who knows what they're doing. But they shouldn't be doing it, so we would turn the lights on and scare them, and a lot of the cars would start up and peel out, thinking that the police were showing up. Well, we were caught one time doing that by the police, and then they issued us a citation that gave us a week to verify that the lights had been disconnected.
And not to mention the 2 million candle-watt spotlight that we would use to burn their retinas out with as we're passing through this parking area so that they would it'd take them a few minutes to get their vision back, and then that way we could get the heck out of town.
Bruce, I understand you had an extra long extension cord on your Farfisa, and that on occasion you would disappear from the stage. What's the story?
Well, you have to understand this. I was playing organ and tambourine. I was not singing. And after hundreds of gigs, literally, you know these songs by heart, I'm bored to death. So why not get a long cord and take that keyboard out in the middle of the dance floor so you can interact with some of the people? Or how about sliding it behind the curtain so you can have a bite to eat? And so there were many times when the guys would look around, they'd hear the organ, but they wouldn't see me. And sometimes they'd just pick up the cord and follow it. They'd find where Bruce ended up with his outfit.
And I understand one night, just by chance, I'm sure, that you ended up directly behind the cage of one of two go-go dancers.
Well, I was concerned about their safety, and I wanted to make sure they didn't fall and get hurt.